This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to John Richardson and the Future Not Series 5, Episode 10, The Future of John Elkington. can we call it that? Is that all right?
I'm sure John would be very, very delighted with that.
John Elkington special. But let's discuss first of all the future of Edgar Lesby and Mark Stevenson. It's Lurgy Week, isn't it? This touch of the curse of the Future Nots podcast here. We've had ill guests in the last 2 weeks and now we have an ill host. How are you, Mark?
Well, I'm much better than I was 2 days ago, where I slept for 18 hours solid, being laid low with some bizarre combination of my face being felt like it was in a vice, runny nose, a hacking cough, a incredible headache, and a general feeling of, I'll never imagine that I could ever be well again.
Mm.
But it's quite good for the ADHD brain, actually, to get ill, because it forces you to do nothing. So basically, I had to just sort of lie there.
And of course, illness is a key part of phasing towards healthiness. So we mustn't eliminate illness altogether.
That's right.
We must embrace illness as part of understanding what a healthy society might look like in the future.
Oh, that is a brilliant optimistic spin on it there, John. I'm impressed.
Well, I'm taking my lessons from COP and I understand that we mustn't phase out bad things altogether too quickly because that will be bad. So what we must do is do bad things for a bit. And then, you know, that gives us time to talk about a better future.
Oh, well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation, especially with John in the mix.
Yeah.
It's slightly more nuanced to it than that, but we'll get to it, I think.
I can't wait. Ed, illness in your house as well?
Yeah, I spent last night clearing up projectile vomit from the landing hallway where my...
Well, you shouldn't drink so much.
I know, my poor wee girl was sick again last night, so... I don't know whether it's another batch of Noro or just an upset tummy from the fish and chips she gorged herself on last night, but that was a disturbing night, which wasn't quite as disturbing as the dream I had the night before, which was one of those, I ate some blue cheese before I went to bed.
Oh, lovely.
I'd forgotten how weird your fever dreams can get on blue cheese. And someone was actually telling me that blue cheese, like as it's broken down in your gut, can create a similar effect to DMT. You know, dimethyltryptamine, which is supposed to be the very intense psychedelic that helps you see God. It's what's in ayahuasca and everything.
Wow. Do you know, I've always wondered why my beloved loved blue cheese.
Yeah, wow. It was wild. I mean, basically, I was on an Arctic expedition to Svalbard or the North Pole or somewhere, specifically to get my teeth fixed by a polar bear dentist. And everyone was telling me that this was a really bad idea. And in the dream, I was going, no, 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 but he's really very good. And then I sort of woke up at the moment this huge bear was over me, about to stick his claw into my mouth to do some artful dentistry. And I woke up going, whoa, that was intense. So Philip Pullman, eat your heart out. You know, Yorick Bernerson is my dentist.
The bear, was it cartoonish? Was it a real bear?
It was a real polar bear. It was very much a planet Earth. This is breathing. I've just eaten a seal breath into my face.
Wow.
As it's doing it. It was vivid.
What do you think that says?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what several people have said. It's like, what would be the Jungian analysis of this, Ed? I have no idea.
Mm. It sounds a superb dream, though.
It's vivid.
I think it's your subconscious thinking about COP.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Because what it's basically saying is we've come to the conclusion now that whatever you're going to do is going to have to be painful. Okay. And actually, the planet is now telling us you've left it too late. So we're going to have to do this thing now. And the polar bear is climate change. And you, as an environmentalist, despite all your best efforts to keep your teeth clean, have come to the point, along with the rest of us, that we have to fundamentally change society, which means you have to give up things. And this is you giving up things as a metaphor for what society has to do. The polar bear is the planet and climate change. You are an environmentalist stuck in the inevitable systems that keep us coming back to these places.
I thought you didn't like woo-woo stuff. That was very good in terms of a Jungian analysis. I would have hoped that, you know, polar bear dentistry without anesthetic wasn't on the list of things I had to go through.
No, it's a metaphor. Ed's coming around for Christmas. It's going to be a very long few days.
Are you having Christmas together?
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. He's going to wake up screaming every night going, no, keep the drill away!
Exactly. I used to sleepwalk as a child as well, so I'm looking forward to that in your house.
Mm. Anyway.
What better opportunity, given the news that you'll be spending Christmas together, than to plug next week's episode, which will be our end of year review / Christmas special. So if you have any Christmas relevant information you want to share or any questions you'd like answered, get those in. Thank you for your feedback on recent episodes. Jez says, a quick search, and yes, you can get non-Cavendish bananas in the UK. This off the back of our Future of Bananas special. Ooh. There's a website called exoticfruits.co.uk. Calling all banana lovers. At least 4 different types of banana. I haven't checked the eco-credentials of exoticfruits.co.uk. So it might be that the good that you're doing by helping to diversify the banana community is undone by the fact that they've got 400 jumbo jets in the air flying blueberries to every corner of the earth. But if you heard that episode and you want to try some bananas, then you can get Motoki bananas, Namwa bananas, red bananas, apple bananas, and others. That's exciting. I might get one of them.
That is exciting. I actually saw a red banana plant actually as well. You know, when you talk about these things and then obviously your confirmation bias brings your attention to them.
That's not true. I've seen a bunch of red banana things. You know, I think she was lying. They're everywhere. It's just we don't notice them. And then as soon as you notice, you know, there's nothing wrong with bananas. They're everywhere.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of them now. If your listeners want to picture them, it's like a banana, but it's red. That's the best way I could describe it.
That's poetic, John.
Yeah, well, I'm really working on my image of me, a metaphor. I'm trying to get a book deal next year.
Oh, are you? What about?
What do red bananas look like? A guide. And thank you to Kev Haggis for our most recent online review.
Is that his real name?
I don't think so.
Because if it is, congratulations. I mean, that is fantastic.
Who says, what could be better than learning whilst laughing? I don't know, so I'll just stick with this because I seem to be enjoying it. Smiley face emoji, thumbs up.
Beautiful.
That's nice, isn't it?
That's lovely. Mm.
Was that a review for our podcast, though?
Oh, I hope so. I haven't clicked on all the others. The people that like this show are very kind about it. The reviews are lovely online.
Well, surely by definition, the people who like it are kind about it. It's the people who don't like it we should be paying attention to, surely.
Oh, I don't know. You've got to indulge in a hate watch every now and again. Do you not watch or listen to things just for the specific aim of hating them? Is that just me?
Nah.
I mean, you don't really have to do because you have to turn on the news.
Yeah, true enough. So I think we're about to be joined by our special guest this week, Mr. John Elkington. So this conversation has to happen quite quickly, but I know somebody on the podcast who's very good at doing things slightly quicker than they should. So our listeners will be keen to know how your speed awareness course went, Ed, and are you better as a person now?
I think so, definitely. It was a bit like the League of Gentlemen, you know, the sort of job seekers character.
Yes, Pauline Spence.
Yeah, the person hosting the course is the only person who's allowed to make a joke. And actually, because they've got a captive audience of people who are legally there under obligation and have to really behave themselves, it allows them to inflict all their humour on you. And then there was one guy in the course who tried to crack a joke and got absolutely slammed for it by the host. And of course, it's not a laughing matter.
And who is this one guy, Ed? Who's this one guy?
Well, it turned out he was an estate agent.
Definitely not you? Okay, definitely not you.
Come on, John. When has Ed ever made a joke?
Yeah, it was. I've actually found it really quite powerful.
Oh, God, a speeding estate agent.
Yeah.
I'm sure the guy's perfectly nice, but An estate agent on a speed awareness course is, ooh, I could draw you a picture of him now.
I know. Mm. And, you know, and in a way, unless you've done your advanced driver training, I mean, I haven't sat down in a kind of instruction session on my driving since I was 17. So, you know, that's 35 years ago. In a way, getting refreshed and learning, actually, the massive difference. I mean, Mark, you were saying last time, slightly frustratingly, that you got done for doing 23 and a 20. But I think one thing the course really rams home is that every mile an hour makes a massive difference to whether you're likely to kill someone. And so, you know, we go, oh, I was only doing 35 and a 30, but that makes you twice as likely to kill someone if you hit them. Mm. So it does matter.
So bear that in mind if you see an estate agent crossing the road.
Well, how positive.
That was obviously a joke. I do not, you know, oh, fuck off. I can't speak.
It's all right. You can't apologize. You made the joke perfectly well. You're perfectly erudite when you're slacking people off. The cough receded and everything.
I do not. What's the word I'm looking for?
You don't want people to run over estate agents.
You know, I'm trying to say I do not admonish violence, but that's not the word, is it? I do not.
Espouse?
Condone.
Condone. That's the word. Why can't I think of that? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
If only we had a guest lined up who is not only an expert in the field, but also very erudite.
If only.
Should we introduce John?
Yes.
Let's do that.
So, how to introduce Mr. John Elkington. I've had the honour of doing this on a few occasions, most recently during an Earth Systems Predictability Forum on artificial intelligence and its potential in climate and biodiversity action, where I introduced John alongside Dr. Lorien Pratt, who is the godmother of decision intelligence. So we introduced John as the godfather of sustainability, but not, I hasten to add, in a sort of Martin Scorsese sense, as some dour Don Corleone Brando-like figure ruling over an unruly crime family of conflicted loyalties with fear and violence. John is very much more the kind and wise paternal force that is always full of generous wisdom and insight and devoid of bed-based horse heads. I first met John while doing my master's degree in sustainability way back in 1997, when he just published his book Cannibals with Forks. John, as we will probably discuss, has written at least 20 books in total, including famously The Green Consumer Guide, One for Us, which is The Power of Unreasonable People, and Green Swans in the last couple of years. He co-founded the agency Sustainability, founded Valans, and sits on around 20 different boards and advisory boards. He's credited with coming up with all sorts of ubiquitously familiar terms in our work and world, like environmental excellence, green growth, the green consumer, the triple bottom line, and people, planet, and profit. He's listed in Who's Who as someone who likes playing with ideas, thinking around corners, having conversations with unreasonable people, which is hopefully why he's here, reading an alpine range of books, and risking life and limb as a London cyclist. He likes to write at all hours of the day or night, is into pre-1944 aircraft, New World wines, 20th century popular music, and Johann Strauss II. John is a Renaissance man. He's got awards, gongs, and recognitions galore. He's been a trusted and consistent voice in our field for decades, long before such causes were popular or fashionable. I think he probably wrote his first book before you were born, John.
Excellent.
So a hugely warm and appreciative welcome to the show, Mr. John Elkington.
Thank you, Ed. That was worth getting out of bed for.
Can I just add a couple of reflections on? Because I just also wanted, just for my own pleasure, really, and so that it's on record, to just say what an inspiration and brilliant man John has been. Like, when you suddenly became aware of the climate and you started campaigning about it, there were very few people 20 years ago that you could really think of as like stalwarts or foundations. And John has always been one of those and has been consistently foundationally brilliant and calm despite all the winds and turmoils that have come. And it's like he's just a very benign presence doing incredibly deep, great work. If there's the nearest thing to a Buddha or a God in sustainability, it's probably John Elkington. And I am delighted he's with us.
Mark, thank you. I think we probably ought to stop there.
Now we can dismantle your reputation.
Yeah, otherwise we're going to end up in Private Eyes, Order of the Brown Nose.
Well, anyway, you've sweetened me up. Now what's next?
Well, John, you're relatively fresh, if that's the right word to describe coming back from 50 degree heat in the Middle East. You're relatively recently back from COP. How was it for you?
Well, it was more like 30 degrees, and it's a part of the world that I absolutely adore. And a few weeks prior to that, my wife and I spent 2 weeks in Jordan, which both of us were profoundly moved by. I mean, with Gaza raging in the background. So it's a turbulent region, and it's a turbulent time for our world. It's a period of massive and, I believe, continuing disruption.
Mm.
COP28 was, I mean, I've always had antibodies to the COP events. I went to the first one the first one for me in Glasgow, which was 26, I think. So this is only my second. And the one thing I really enjoyed beyond measure was meeting so many people, both known and unknown, in such a concentrated period of time, because it's quite the expo site and Dubai is a pretty sprawling one, and so you had to walk a lot, although you had electric scooters and trolley buses and so on going back and forth, but just constantly meeting people and plunging into all sorts of conversations, and I really, really enjoyed that. It was the odd thing was that as we flew in, I was saying to a colleague that I really felt oddly optimistic about this COP, and it was partly, you know, Sultan Ahmed Al Jaber, who is a very peculiar creature, but he had the history of being the founding CEO at Masdar City, which we also visited on this trip. And a lot of people have been profoundly disappointed by the outcome. I actually think in the big picture, it's a huge advance. I think getting fossil fuels into the language of these agreements has been bitterly resisted by the fossil fuels industry for a very long time. And now it's in. And I think I think that every so often, if you think about a piece of fabric or material, you get a slight crack, a small tear, and then over time, and sometimes, you know, in a spectacularly short period of time, that split, that tear can open up profoundly. And I think that's where we are, and it's up to us to make sure that the paradigm does shift. The fossil fuels industry are progressively driven out of the picture, but we've got to think about this much more seriously than we have to date, because it's the biggest change certainly in my lifetime, and I don't think we planned for it. But it like bit like Brexit. Back to you too,
because it's sort of mad that it's taken this long to get that terminology into the agreement, isn't it? I mean, the very fact that, you know, it's ridiculous that it's taken decades to even actually have the wording specifically around fossil
it's
fuels
criminal.
In there. But yeah. But as you say, at least it begins to draw the line in the sand, pun intended. But obviously, it's also not enough, is it? I mean, that's the question. And I think, you know, we've discussed this many times on the podcast. I think it was Vinny Gupta who said, you know, there are some industries that will need to be phased out, and then some will need to be done forcefully. And I suspect that that's going to be the case with fossil fuels. It's not going to be done voluntarily. It is going to have to be done through compulsion.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's often struck me is the similarities, in a way, between an earlier energy economy based on slavery and how our own country, the United Kingdom of Britain, got itself progressively out of that by spending something like 40% of revenues, government revenues, over 2 years to buy out, and it sounds loathsome to say it now, but the property rights of slave owners. And I have a horrible feeling we're going to have to do that again, although it you know, pains me to say it. But we can't simply shut down the coal, oil, gas companies and expect their shareholders to lump it. There's going to have to be transitional arrangements, which I don't see many people thinking about properly.
That's one of the things, as the sort of layperson on this podcast, that we discussed in series one, I think, and I'd never even entertained the idea that at some point you will have to pay oil states not to dig oil out of the ground. I wondered, John, you've said obviously it's going to be difficult and it's unpalatable, but it feels at the moment in a world where even just having a COP in an oil state has driven those on the sort of progressive side of the sort of environmental argument to just completely disengage from COP altogether and say it's a waste of time. How do you envisage that even happening then?
Well, firstly, having this event in the UAE and in Dubai was a shock to us all. And to have it now going on to Azerbaijan just compounds that shock. Mm. But in a funny way, I think it puts this agenda right at the roiling heart of the fossil fuels economy. And if we play it right, I think that could be valuable. I should just say one thing, which is, as I said earlier on, I have antibodies to COPs. That's largely because I don't like large concentrations of politicians. I don't like small concentrations of them either. I try and avoid them, but here we are. And the UN, although I think it is in many ways weaker than it needs to be and in some senses failing, this is a key part that it can play. And I think its Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been spectacularly courageous in the sort of line he's been taking in public and virtually calling the fossil fuels companies. And we should be very careful. This isn't just about the oil companies, big coal, big oil, and so on. It's, as you said, it's about the states whose entire economies are built around these resources. But I think two things are happening at the same time. I think one is that the UN process is getting to some sort of inflection point, and it's driven by when I say inflection point, you know, very often exponentials build for a very, very long time out of sight. And that can be 30, 40, 50 years in some cases. I think that's what's been happening with the climate and sustainability agendas. And then you get a period of time when in ridiculous short order, things change to a complete, what would have once seemed an impossible degree. And I think we're very close into that. The problem is when that happens, when that sort of thing happens, it triggers all sorts of resistance. And we see that in very dilute and weak forms currently with the anti-ESG, environment, social and governance approaches to business and investment, anti-woke and so on. It's not that there haven't been excesses. I'm not personally a great supporter of ESG. I mean, it provides some sort of service and some sort of focus, but I think it needed challenge. I think we are at an inflection point. I think things are going to change profoundly, but the problem always is that you then get the responses. And unless you're set up to deal with those, and that's why I think, you know, if people are backing off this process, saying, you know, it's in Dubai or the UAE, that's beyond the pale, we're not going to go, they're almost taking their hands off the steering wheel at exactly the point where we need to be guiding the process more assiduously and more cleverly than perhaps we have done to date.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply with UiPath, the world's number one AI-powered business automation platform. UiPath, the foundation of innovation.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Wondersuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Learn more at Bluehost.com/Wondersuite.
You've often said this before, John, and I've taken this as a bit of key wisdom from you. Is like it's very difficult to perceive a paradigm shift when you're in the middle of it, and it can often feel imperceptible, as you say, because of those long timescales. The question that I sit with now, though, is like, can we actually tell the difference between breakdown and breakthrough when they could be sort of happening simultaneously? How do we get our heads around that particular sort of paradox that obviously it feels like the ecosystem and the climate system and biodiversity is to a certain extent unraveling, and at the same time that exponential momentum for change is also building? How do you make sense of that sort of very difficult tension?
Well, you're making a wild assumption there, Ed, that I do make sense of it. But the way that I try to get my brain or bits of my brain around it is by thinking that breakdown and breakthrough happen simultaneously at moments like this. Mm. Very often breakdown happens faster. And I think we're beginning to see some quite powerful warning signs around, you know, sort of surfaces of oceans and so on, warming at a quite spectacularly unparalleled rate. But you know, I wrote my first report on climate change way back in 1978, and it was for somebody who called Herman Kahn, who was one of the architects of the U.S. Mutually Assured Destruction, or MAD, nuclear strategy. I think he's probably one of the two or three most intelligent people I've ever met. He became a model for Dr. Strangelove, if you ever saw that film. He said to me at the time, which has always stuck in my mind, and for 50 years I've tried to duck the label environmentalist, because people then think they know what you're going to say and discount 99% of it. That's changed a bit recently. But my report basically said, there are four big issues coming at the world by the early years, and this was back in the 1970s, by the early 21st century. One of them is going to be climate change. And what he said was that the problem with you environmentalists is that you're on a motorbike and you're headed towards a chasm, and what you do is try and stamp on the brakes and steer away. And maybe what you should be doing is putting your foot flat to the floor and seeing if you can't jump the chasm or canyon. And this was just after a guy called Evel Knievel had jumped a very small part of the Grand Canyon, having broken every bone in his body in various attempts to do things like that. And at the time, I thought Kahn was clinically insane. And then over time, I began to realize that as we allow time to go by, we're leaving ourselves less and less time to go through this sort of set of transformations. And therefore, we're going to have to do it spectacularly fast. And I don't think the sustainability industry, if I can call it that, is currently configured to do that remotely.
Mm.
People who have done elements of that tend to be, you know, in the Silicon Valley world. That's where you find the crazies, the exponential thinkers, and so on.
John, I want to ask you a question, because you've done a lot of work with business. You're very well respected in the business world as well as the sort of environmental world, which is one of your great strengths. And I've recently sort of by accident moved into a commercial world, setting up a carbon removals accelerator with Gabriel Walker, who with you know. And what's been interesting about that is like seeing the pace and the ambition and the entrepreneurship that comes with doing that kind of thing. And then just occasionally, I would not say very often, but just occasionally getting this kind of sniff of people going like, well, you can't possibly do that. That's a bit unseemly. As an environmentalist, I'm supposed to sit on the sidelines and complain about things a lot.
Yeah.
But actually, I would never dare touch any money or influence whatever to change anything about it, because that would be impure. And sometimes you get this strange pushback from, in a way, is there a bit of sustainability that's so comfortable complaining about the status quo that it really wants the status quo to stay where it is so it can carry on complaining and therefore, you know, be comfortable in what it's been used to doing?
Well, I totally understand with that pushback, and I empathize with it in many ways. I think the great danger, though, now is that capitalism and markets are beginning to wake up both to the threats and to the opportunities. And when that happens, things start to happen at lightning speed, and many NGOs will be completely sidelined. I really would regret that. As an outcome, because I think one of the things that really struck me about Dubai was how micromanaged and tidy or tidied up the civil society world was. They were all sort of these little booths, and it was almost like a sort of a country fair. Whereas, you know, we know that civil society at its best is untidy, unruly, noisy, messy, all the rest of it. That doesn't particularly fit the UAE mindset. So I think money is going to have to be made for this thing to move at the sort of pace and scale that it needs to move at. I think we'll have new multi-billionaires, a bit like sort of Gates and Skoll and Zuckerberg and that sort of set of people in the past, you know, new economy period. And it will lead to extreme excesses. And therefore, I think the role of politicians and of regulators and so on is going to be massively important in trying to sort of you mentioned AI earlier on, and I think that that's just a relatively small example of the sorts of ethical and governance and political challenges that we're going to face as this sort of stuff roars through. So while I sympathize with people who said, you know, these are not people we love, these, you know, business leaders and all the rest of it, entrepreneurs, I think we're going to have to engage with these people because that's that they're going to shape the future much more powerfully now than the Greenpeaces and the Amnesties and people like that, who, you know, I grew up with, I adore to pieces, but the problem is they're very likely to be elbowed aside quite sharply in the coming, not just decades, years.
Listen to you just describing that, John. How do you maintain that sort of preternatural calm? Because, you know, you've been writing this stuff since 1978. You know, I think it's fair to say that on this podcast, we have our occasional rant. You know, Mark has used some fairly fruity and colourful language over five series to describe our frustrations. But you seem to manage to have a not a dispassion, because obviously you're clearly incredibly passionate, but you have this calm. I mean, are you chopping logs at home? Do you meditate? Do you scream into the pillow? How do you vent what must be also a sense of frustration of having worked in this for so long and actually seen relatively little change in the fact that, you know, there's a big disconnect between the ambitions and aspirations we'd all know and love to see and we know are possible and the shortfall that inevitably comes. So how do you maintain your calm?
Well, I must take those prescriptions and try them out, whether it's breathing into a pillow or chopping logs or chopping pillows and breathing into a log.
Screaming into a pillow.
I think I was born with Not a preternatural calm, but I mean, I it's there. It's part of the wiring. But at the same time, I'm also, I've always said that I may sound like an Old Testament prophet at times, because you can just see a system collapsing before it starts to go, and I've seen that for decades now, and I think we've left it way too late to sort of get a properly orderly transition in place. But when you ask, Ed, what sort of gives me the confidence to be in some ways a calm voice in all of this, it's several things. One is, if you rant in a boardroom, you're thrown out of that boardroom. If you speak in a way which is gets people leaning in because they can't quite hear you, well, I'm slightly exaggerating there, but if you speak lower than most people do, when you'll know this, speaking in public, if you lower your voice, people go quiet and start to pay attention. And so one of the things I've learned over time, that it actually can pay dividends to be a little bit calmer than and quieter than some people might be in those circumstances. The other thing, though, and I've said this so often, but it's true. When I was 14, I read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, and it was the first book. It was published in 1962, I think. I read it in 63, and it was about how paradigm shifts go through, and it was the first book on all of that. And it had an absolutely profound influence on me, because I suddenly realized that the really big changes in civilizations, in cultures, in societies, in science, tend to take about 70 to 80 years to crank through. And they tend to accelerate in the last 10 to 15 years to an unconscionable degree. Well, I track back the blue planet Lovelock paradigm to late 50s, when James Lovelock was doing early work with his electron capture detector. So I think we're 60 plus years into a process. And in a way, that's almost the historic framework that I operate within. It could be delusional. I mean, who knows? We may just simply crash this time around. But I don't know. I feel our species tends to do its best work when it's backed into a corner. And I've often said that here we are in the mother of all corners.
How do you marry that sense of calm and a belief that that voice is what is key to progress in one element with the just stop oil and the more vocal, perhaps shouty elements of climate activism?
Well, I think we need. I mean, no, look. I mean, I may seem calm at times, but as I think as Ed said, I hold a great deal of stress. And when I heard even this sort of relatively feeble outcome from COP28, I was in tears because it seemed until such a late stage to be going the wrong way, which may simply have been gaming by the oil industry or whatever. But you know, to get those words into that agreement, I thought was a big step forward. Now, Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion and so on absolutely will not agree with that, nor should they. And I subscribe very much to the Andreas Mann, you know, his book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline line, that when you get these major changes going through our society, there is no way that by having sort of calm, soft-spoken people talking to power, that change is going to happen. You need the absolute palpable threat of violence and the actuality of violence. And one of the things that Mom, as you will remember, says is that, you know, with slavery, it wasn't polite, genteel, middle-class ladies giving up sugar in their tea. It was evisceration of entire families of slave owners and the stringing up of plantation managers and so on in the Caribbean that so shocked Europe that we began to realize that this is not sustainable. If you go back to the civil rights period, Martin Luther King would not have had the success that he did, although it was limited, with JFK and so on, if it had not been for Malcolm X in the background. And it, with the suffragettes, it was only when they went around smashing windows, hundreds of windows in Whitehall, that people began to take them seriously. So I really admire younger people who are clearly feeling the anxiety and the way that their parents' generations are not to anything like the same extent, beginning to take direct action. The one thing I would say is do it, but be acutely aware that as you do it, you're going to trigger reactions that you don't really understand. So you've got to be, so shutting down subway trains or blocking motorways is not wildly clever because it just infuriates ordinary people. And what Mom says is go blow up oil pipelines. Now, I'm not necessarily prescribing that, no more than I would prescribe hallucinogens. But you know, if this is going to work, we need a palpable sense of fear. And just final point. I mean, for those of your listeners who haven't read Kim Stanley Robinson's book, Ministry for the Future, you know, there is a, I think it's about a page and a half in the middle of that book where suddenly you've got a black ops group coming up and they start assassinating the CEOs of oil companies and so on. And from that moment on, the arc of change starts to change quite palpably.
Yeah. Have you read Stephen Markley's The Deluge?
Nope, I haven't. I should.
No, so this is another, I guess it's a sort of follow-on. It's what I would call a throughtopia, but it has very similar kind of plot points as Stanley Robinson. And it tracks, you know, the reality of what happens when you get this friction between society and the system. And, you know, it's actually even more brutal in some ways than some elements of Kim Stanley Robinson's book. But I think you're right.
I think the system tends to hunker down and become acutely defensive. And the 60s, I had friends who joined groups like the Angry Brigade. One of them went to prison for 10 years. And they tried to change the system by blowing it up. It doesn't work. It doesn't mean that the calculated use of violence cannot produce dividends. It can. But if you simply lose your rag and try to kill government ministers or whatever, the police state comes down on you like a ton of bricks. So it's really complicated. And where I can, I try and support some of those younger direct action people because I think what they're doing is absolutely critically important. But I also remember the early years of NGOs like Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. And I saw quite a number of people burn out because just their passion drove them too fast. I remember Andrew Lees dying in Madagascar campaigning against a big sort of mining company just from a heart attack. And I think one of the things that we've got to do as sort of, not including you particularly in this, but as almost sort of a growing group of elders, people have been doing this for a while, we've really got to embrace and engage and nurture and support in any way we can the younger generation of activists.
Well, that's why we have John on the show, John Richardson, because
the next generation.
You know, we feel that, you know, that he needs embracing and holding.
Embracing.
Yeah.
I believe this is audio only.
When does that start, Mark? When do I get my first audio hug?
I'll give you. How do you give an audio hug? Do you think? I'm nice to you all the time.
Is it prog rock? It better not be prog rock.
Doug, everybody knows the prog rock will eventually save the world.
It's news to me,
John. We need to sit down and have a chat, John Elkton and me, about the role of progressive rock in saving the future. As you say, you know, these things take 60, 70 years to play out. And once you've seen it at the beginning,
that sounds like a prog album,
you know? Yeah. So I saw the role of prog rock, you know, saving, you know, the planet, the universe, you know, at the beginning. And I'm watching it play out. So I have that same calmness that you have, I think. And I understand that eventually the overlong guitar solo and the slightly fantastical elongated lyrical suite will eventually be the thing that saves us all.
Well, I only have one word to that, which is yes.
But given a choice, John, between sort of progressive rock or poetry, which would you choose?
Poetry.
We'll edit a pause in just for Mark's mental well-being. We'll edit some thinking time in.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools. I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
John, so there's another thing here, though. So obviously you've got this incredible long view, you know, because you've been looking at this for decades. What's the most egregious thing you've ever heard someone say in a meeting? You know, that moment where you're just going, oh, God, they really don't get this, do they? I mean, I can think of a couple. Like, there was a large pharmaceutical company I would work with years ago who we were talking about stakeholder consultation. This gentleman said, I don't think you get this. He goes, we decide what our stakeholder issues are. No, it actually works the other way around.
Right.
You know, and you hear these things. And another one, I think when we were working with a large consultancy on their purpose, and literally the CEO turned around and said, this is not a Miss World competition, you know, we're not trying to win a kind of ethical beauty contest. And it was like, wow, okay, you actually just said that. But you know, you must have heard some corkers over the years.
Well, a couple of things came to mind when you asked the question, Ed. And the first one was probably about 35 years ago, working with Procter & Gamble, and very senior woman in the company. We were having a meeting in Amsterdam. And she just said, I wish there was a pill which the rest of the world could swallow to see the world as we see it. And you felt she was on the verge of putting it into the water supply. But the one that came to mind first was up in Norway in Stavanger. I was speaking at a conference with 300 oil and gas people. It's a sort of epicenter of that Norwegian fossil fuels industry. And I was on stage, and I was talking about the way in which Exxon, as part of ExxonMobil, had corrupted the political process around climate over decades. When who should walk into the back of the room but Rex Tillerson, who was, you know, chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil at the time. And he was very elegantly suited and coated and so on and surrounded by an entourage. And he roared from the back of the conference room, "That is a goddamn lie." So he and I then proceeded to have an exchange over the heads of 300 baffled Scandinavian fossil fuel people, after which I continued what I was saying, which was that ExxonMobil had corrupted the political process over decades. He came up onto the stage afterwards, and we sort of got on moderately well. I mean, he's a diplomat. He ended up as Secretary of State, didn't he? But 2 weeks later, New York State sued ExxonMobil for corruption of the political process over decades. So it's often said that the louder people shout and roar against what you're saying, the more you know they're lying. He knew he was lying, and ExxonMobil has been progressively exposed. It knew the science, you know, 40 plus years ago, and it tried to bury it. It's still trying to.
We're pretty much broadly where they predicted we would be, aren't we?
Absolutely, spot on, as it happens. I mean, I think that's it's a slight coincidence, but the modelling was actually quite clever.
You've had one might consider a very auspicious career. You know, certainly I think you can hear from the tone of us on the podcast that we greatly admire you. I think one of the things that I admire the most about you is your humility as well and your ability to sort of own up to either mistakes or kind of think, oh, I could have done that better or learn from stuff. What's been one of your biggest learning experiences or things you thought, oh, God, could have done that a bit better?
Well, the first thing to say is I've never felt I've had a career. I mean, not in the sense that you know what you're doing and there's a professional core to it. I've often said that I feel I've stumbled backwards into one area after another, driven by what I didn't want to do as much as by what I did.
So not so much a career, more careering about.
Exactly that. Actually, I shall use that nonstop. Thank you. I've just finished a new book, which is partly looking back over 50 years of work and then looking into the next 15 years and basically saying I think like 15 we'll see more change than the last 50. But in terms of mistakes, there are so many. I mean, I think of working with Ford at one stage and getting Bill Ford to go public. This is in the very early days of sport utility vehicles, SUVs. And he and I were asked to do an interview for the first sustainability report. And I think it was 4 or 6 pages, the interview in the front of the report. And this is the early part of the century. And I just asked him questions and I got him to express what was on his mind, which was that SUVs were unsustainable. They happened to make a huge amount of money. It was about $14,000 on every SUV versus cents on smaller Ford vehicles. But when that report came out, he got absolutely pilloried for about 2 days. You know, poor little rich boy, by right-wing people. And I had assumed that Ford would have put the whole thing, the interview, through their lawyers, but they hadn't, or it didn't seem that they had. So he really got hammered. And then, you know, it came good. And every so often, we've given advice to business leaders, which has landed them in hotter water than I expected they had imagined they would get into. And working with Ford and companies later, like, I previously worked with Volvo, and when Volvo were bought by Ford, that's when I started to work with Ford and Toyota and so on. Product recalls are almost every day occurrences. So Tesla's got a call out for I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of cars to update their self-driving software.
2 million.
2 million, yeah. Then with the triple bottom line, I mean, I came up with that in 1994, already mentioned, and you know, that had gone out. We'd now say it was viral. It became part of the wider conversation, whatever it is, over 7,000 B corporations now are chartered around that sort of thinking or conceptual framework. But I saw evidence of, and to some degree growing evidence of, the fact that people were misinterpreting the original intent of the triple bottom line, which was that it was about integrated performance against all three economic, including financial, social, and environmental performance. And what we were seeing is trade-offs still. People still saying, you know, well, I've made a profit. That's a tick in the economic box. We employ people. Shame about the environment. Or whichever way the equation was run. So I thought, I'm not deeply logical. I mean, I'm not an Einstein or anything like that. I tend to think in bursts, and stuff tends to creep up on me and jump out of the hedgerows. With this one, I just suddenly thought we should do a product recall on the triple bottom line, because I think it needs rethinking. And I suggested at the Harvard Business Review, they obviously leapt on it because they loved the idea. They said it was the first time that any management, whatever, thinker had withdrawn their concept, and they basically wanted me to say I was going to kill it. That was never the idea. It was a product recall in the sense that something was out there that was being improperly understood, improperly used, and we needed to reflect on that.
Yeah, in terms of being improperly used, have you ever done another Petra Kucha, John? I was saying, just for context here. No, exactly. I inflicted a Petra Kucha, which if people don't know what that is, it's a style of presentation where you have a self-automated presentation, which is 20 slides for 20 seconds each. And it was a technique.
It's a hideous idea.
Yeah, developed in Japan to stop Japanese architects talking interminably about their work. So the idea is, you know, you're presentation will finish in 6.5 minutes, whether you do or not. And I had an event which John very kindly came and spoke at, and it wasn't a great experience, was it, John?
It wasn't. Two or three points in my life where things have gone completely off the rails, and that was certainly one of them.
What happened? Did you turn up naked or were you drunk?
I can't remember. Elaine, my wife of 55 years, says I have one of my great life skills is I forget all the bad stuff very, very quickly. So Ed may remember, I don't.
I think it was more you were being your typical articulate and erudite self, but unfortunately the slides were just doing their own thing in the background because they were moving on every 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying to me afterwards, I never want to do one of those ever again.
On that point of 20 slides for 20 seconds, I'm aware that we shouldn't keep you forever. But to our listeners, I think, because we have listeners to this podcast who are sort of 18, 19 and at the start of their journey and are asking us questions about how to get involved and what companies they should look to work with. We've got listeners, you know, at the other end of life who find now they've got perhaps the time and space to think about these things that they haven't had before. Mm. I think the question we get asked most consistently by all of them is just how you cope over a period. And as I say, some of these have been thinking about these things for years and some for decades. What's your advice and interpretation of how to deal with the ups and downs of now 50 years of caring and being compassionate about something that matters so much?
Well, I think one of the things is befriend people across not just one movement, but across multiple movements. And I've been extremely lucky throughout my working life to have made huge numbers of friends, and some of them were activists and campaigners, some of them were investors, some of them were CEOs. It's a very mixed bag, and I think alongside having it's not in everyone's control, but you know, sort of strong family behind you. Certainly in my case, that's been enormously important. But one thing right at the end of this new book, I conclude by saying is that younger people have on a number of occasions said to me, particularly in places like Brazil, they wish that they had been around for the glory days, the golden years of sustainability and the environment and so on. And my response has been, and it remains, we haven't had them yet.
Absolutely.
And they're still to come. And so in many ways, even though I'm 74, I'm 75 next year, and I feel I'm only just beginning to get started in this space. And the next 10 to 15 years are going to be outlandishly exciting, challenging, and politically.
I think that's really true, John. Ed and I often said, like, you know, we've been in training, you know, all our careers for this. So far. And actually, this is our Olympics, you know, the next 10 or 15 years is like, this is what we've been in training for. All the rest was kind of like, you know, heats and competitions and local athletics meets and, you know, nationals. And now this is the Olympics for the next 10 years. So, absolutely.
It's a mixed bag because it's got sprinting elements, and it's got marathon elements, and it's got changing the rule of the whole game. Elements. But just a final point, reflection in a way. I'm one of the baby boomers, for better or worse, and I see a lot of people of my age now retiring and basically saying, you know, we tried, we were environmentalists, and now we'll hand it over to younger people. And I think that's deadly dangerous. I think this needs to be a pan-generational project. We need to find much better ways of engaging the young and the old. And I think one of the problems with the aging trend in our societies is that people get grayer, they get more conservative, and they want their pension funds invested in safer bets at exactly the moment where we need to be blowing things up and disrupting and taking bigger risks. So that sort of pan-generational dynamic, I think, is going to be immensely important. I don't think at the moment we see any politician in countries where I operate properly understanding that, let alone addressing it. So it's a challenge for us all.
So the good news about that is, I think, because I think we'll have to let you go now, John, is that what you're saying to us is that you're not going anywhere anytime soon, which fills me, and I'm sure a lot of people listen to this with a great amount of joy, that you will still be out there doing the John thing with that slightly wry smile of yours and that deep calmness in the face of the storm. And I am personally very, very happy about that.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Ed. And thank you, John. I've enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to continuing it in different forms.
Well, there we go. That's one of my favourite shows we've done. With no offence, of course, to all the other shows we've done, which were also great. But I found that very reassuring.
Why?
Well, I think one of the things we've talked about a lot is the idea that everyone's in their little bubbles, and there's a great clash between the Just Stop Oil movement and the sort of I'm not going to do anything movement and the COP political side of it. And what I got from that was a sense of they're all doing their own thing. And actually, when you hear people like John talk very calmly about the need for all of those things and that you don't have to be defined by one, we've just all got to be doing our thing and moving forward. And there's something about hearing somebody of that generation and of that class and intellect sort of say, I'm quite glad people are going out and blowing stuff up. Don't mind a bit of that. Really liked that.
Yeah, I like that as well. The other thing I really took from that was this idea of the product recall of an idea. You kind of think, oh God, if only we could have done that, I don't know, with capitalism. You know, when Adam Smith had written The Wealth of Nations, if he'd have sort of put it out there and gone, oh, hang on a minute. I need to put ecology in here, and also, oh yeah, sorry, it was a bit sexist. So can I just can we have it all back? And I'll give it you back, and you know, I'm going to do a rewrite and give it you back in 6. Wouldn't that have been brilliant? We would have saved so much hassle. But we're having to do the product recall now on the current version of capitalism by basically destroying the planet and rebuilding it whilst we're flying the fucking plane.
I'm trying to think about what I'd recall. Oof.
Which of your shows would you recall?
No question whatsoever. Don't Happy Be Worry.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing.
What was so bad about it?
I just wasn't in a well state of mind. And I think that came across. I think anyone who leaves the show more worried about the performer than they were than they arrived should get a refund. There's a whole show about me basically having a meltdown in Swindon at 2 o'clock in the morning and spitting at a traffic light that had gone red when I was trying to get home. And, you know, I could have done with a bit of therapy rather than an Edinburgh show deadline. So to anyone who saw that show, I apologise and I recall it immediately.
Excellent. See, you've done it.
Yeah.
Do you think you'd go back, revisit it and put it out again?
I'm sure there were good routines in there. Yeah, I'm sure there's stuff that could have a better life. But I think a fallow year in Edinburgh.
Ed, what would you recall?
Well, you want me to recall my poetry books, don't you?
No. This is not about me. I'm asking you genuinely. It's interesting that you leapt to that because I think that's just something that's going on in your subconscious that you really want to say. But this is a free space.
I don't know. Actually, well, it's related to John as well. So I gave this big keynote speech in Bonn, the Bonn speech on global transformation. And I had a keynote and I was speaking alongside John Elkington. And John came up to me afterwards, goes, I really enjoyed that. It reminded me of Ursula K. Le Guin, the sci-fi writer. And I guess I would recall it because I think what I said in that speech, which was in 2015, was actually some quite naive idealism. And I stand by, you know, some of the idealism, but I think I was slightly naive in the way I pitched it to what was actually an incredible audience in the old German Parliament building, you know, where you stand. Mm. It's an incredible circular space, you know, when they rebuilt Parliament buildings to make them less confrontational rather than one side to the other, you know. So you stood on this blue circle in the middle and basically had people all around you. And there was another guy in the audience who came up and said, he goes, yeah, it reminded me of what people used to say in the 60s when they took too many hallucinogenics. And it was like, yeah. So, I mean, you can still watch that talk online. It's a lovely talk, but I think my idealism was a little bit naive.
Oh, you're very brave to not only want to recall it, but then basically put a link out so people can see it. But I'm very pleased to report, if you want to see the show I recalled, there's not a fucking trace of that anywhere. So good luck with that.
You've destroyed it.
It's only in the very recesses of the minds of the poor bastards who saw that show.
Mm. It wasn't a DVD?
Absolutely not. No. This was, thankfully, this is pre-DVD.
Oh, my God.
This was, I had a piece of classical music playing as people walked in. It was just, you know, there were many signs. Many signs.
It's amazing how secret our lives were before this ubiquity of technology, wasn't it? You know, you could get away with doing shows or talks without people being quoting you or recording it or sharing an embarrassing snippet years later.
Mm. Absolutely. Everything is public now. Everybody's got a fucking podcast. Anyway, it'll be our Christmas special next week. Our email address is hello@johnandthefuturenauts.com. What's our Twitter handle, Ed?
@JandTheF.
And if you want to find like-minded people in the real world, why not type in People Planet Pint, our official partner for JandTheF listeners to get together in pubs, save the planet, and drink beer.
I think this has been one of our best series. I think we've had some lovely shows. And I think that, you know, another, I'm always mentioning the questions we get the most, and they're always about how you cope and your mental well-being and things like that. And the one I never mention is the number of people who say you can't actually really be friends with the way you talk to each other. So next week, we've already said that you two will be spending Christmas together. I'll have a little glass of something on the go if it's our festive special.
Yeah.
I'll have a bit of tofu nog. Or something like that.
I mean, I think we are recording it at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, so that's going to be quite a start to the day.
Don't you worry about that.
Tofu nog. Can you make it sound any more appetizing?
Banana blossom nog, I should probably do. As
Oh, my God.
At least the brandy will help it slip down.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I might be like the banana blossom curry I promised to make. I might just have a look at it and then decide just to have a brandy instead. Thank you to both of you. Thank you to John. And thank you to everyone for listening. And thank you to, I don't know, who should we thank at random? I'm going to thank Johnny Ball.
Johnny Ball, think of a number.
Thanks, Johnny Ball.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, again, as John Elkington was saying, Johnny Ball famously kind of started not being that informed on climate, but yet he was really important in helping, you know, me as a young child develop kind of a rational mindset through all of his great shows.
Oh, don't say. Has he said silly things about the planet?
He has, yeah.
Yeah, he went a bit mad. He went a bit mad, a bit like David Bellamy did as well. But let's not go there with, like, our childhood icons that went crazy.
But I do remember Johnny Ball, when I came to London as a young boy with my mum, Johnny Ball sat opposite us on the tube, but I didn't notice because I was engrossed in something. And as he got off, my mum went, "Isn't that man off the telly?" And I looked up and looked straight into his eyes, and I was, and he just gave me the broadest smile, the sort of smile that only a child's entertainer can give to a child. And it filled my heart with joy that he'd smiled, and he gave me a little wave and he wandered off. And that was like one of the best moments of my young life.
Oh, well, there you go. I was right to thank Johnny Ball.
Yeah, but yeah, then he started denying the climate. So you see, you know, then it's...
I know, but that's sort of... Maybe he knows that in some way he's inspired you to have the confidence and faith in the world to follow your own path. So he's like, well, do you know what? There wouldn't be a Mark Stevenson if I hadn't smiled at him on the tube. So I can say what I like now.
I wonder how Fatboy Slim got on with the in-laws.
I always wondered about that. They're not together anymore, are they?
No, but I think they're still friends.
I can't believe we've gone from John Elkington to discussing celebrity marriages.
There's a whole new podcast in this, a spin-off. John Richardson in the Future Noughts Heat Special. We discuss the heat of the planet. Let's discuss Heat Magazine. Oh, I'd love to do a special with you two. I'm going to get you some questions ready.
Get me on celebrity culture.
Get you some questions for next week on celebrity marriages.
Oh, my God.
Right, here we
go. This is going to reveal just how out of touch Ed and I are.
We are. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Stay tuned for the Christmas special to hear the question you've always wanted the answer for. Just how long have Meryl Streep and Don Gummer been together? Never heard of Don Gummer, and it's 40 years. Who else is together? Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds.
Okay.
Yeah, heard of them?
No, I've heard of Ryan Reynolds. I had to cancel a call with Ashton Kutcher this week because I was ill, and I just got a little email from him saying, "Get well soon." And I thought, "Oh, Hollywood film stars just asked me to get well. It's quite nice."
Yeah,
there you go. That's some celeb gossip for you.
Yeah, full of celeb gossip. This is going to be a hell of a show. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Hey.